overwhelming. And to reflect on what is the purity of love is something which I think needs to be clarified. We can all say that we long to love ourselves more deeply. We also long to feel connected to other people in a better way. And as we've seen here these few days, it's not always easy to feel connected with oneself and feel connected with somebody else, whomever, even the person we love the most. We often feel contraction in our hearts, and that comes from a fear of intimacy with ourselves. This fear of intimacy prevents us from really opening up. And if you look into yourselves just tonight, how you feel tonight compared to maybe the first night you came, how does your body feel? How does your heart feel? Doesn't mean that you're not experiencing pain, but are we not more open? There is a sense of connection which has been established just because we have been through the fear of intimacy. So I think that we can say that we all crave for love, crave so much that we really don't know where to look for it. We feel very lonely very often, not knowing how to make ourselves understand. The craving, in fact, is the source of the root of suffering. It is only the craving that is the root of the suffering, the source. And we mistake this craving for love. So in a way, the spiritual practice, what we've been doing here, is really uprooting these forces of greed, hatred, and delusion, of ignorance, of desire. They are uprooted, and they're called the kilesas. In Pali, the defilements or the torments of the mind. And what is absolutely wonderful is that they are veils. Just like Charles spoke about the glass, which takes a certain color, if the color is there, but it doesn't taint the nature of the mind. It doesn't taint the nature of the heart. The veils, they're torments of the mind, which means that our very nature is completely pure and radiant and open and unobstructed. And the practice is just that, to unveil the greed, the hatred, the delusion. So these torments of the mind are visitors, but we believe that they are true. We believe very strongly, in fact, that they are here, and the fact that we have this belief of knowing nothing else than the torments of the mind, the desire, the ignorance, and the greed, and the aversion, and the hatred, we mistake our own nature with the nature of the mind, which is completely free and liberated. And this is exactly what the path means. The Dalai Lama said that the importance is to just recognize over and over again what is our true heart. He says, you know, he was asked what is his religion, and I think probably some of you have heard the statement, which is absolutely fantastic. The Dalai Lama says, My religion is just kindness. What a beautiful religion. Kindness. Just because his way of knowing himself is so deep that he did uproot the greed, the ignorance, the desire, and all the defilements. And he also says, even if we don't understand the world, all the actions that everyone does, all the deeds are accomplished by people in order to feel happiness, in order to be free of suffering. Now, even if a person is acting not at all in a pure way and may harm somebody else or himself or herself, he is acting out of a wish to be free from suffering. Except that action comes out of ignorance. So it isn't pure. That action is coming out of craving, which is completely different from an action which comes from a pure heart. The perfect example today is the Dalai Lama. So in fact, it's the conditioning in our minds that is acted out. But what we do is we mistake the conditioning for our true nature. And if we see and if we hear, not that we know maybe tonight that there is a true nature, we've touched upon it many times, you know. I mean, insights to know that we are feeling angry today and that we can let go of that anger. That's one of the first insights, and it shows that we are really liberated from that anger. That's the true nature. Therefore, we can work on ourselves. We can work on ourselves in a way that there is a practice and there is a possibility to be free from suffering. The heart is open, it's radiant, it's unobstructed, it's completely spacious, it's boundless, as we say. It has no limit of time, or it has no limit of space. Beautiful. The Buddha said that the spiritual path is the one that leads to freedom, as the liberation of the heart, which is love. What we do here is we liberate the heart, which is love. And the loving kindness practice, which he taught, is a practice that enables the heart to move from contraction, from isolation, from separation, to that connection, to that connectedness, to that feeling of being completely liberated. Not that we should not do vipassana, because vipassana enables us to have the wisdom to uproot. Loving kindness opens our heart, and then the vipassana flows through our heart, which is open, and we can see the wisdom arise. So it's not that the loving kindness is a meditation that will free us from these torments of the mind, but they are a concentration practice, and they open the heart, they just liberate the heart, which means then that the vipassana can be really dealt in a completely different manner. And it's less dry. We can say that the connection that the loving kindness meditation does is that the example given is two pieces of wood that you would like to put together, dry wood. There's absolutely no possibility to make them fit together. We need some moisture, you know? So the liberating factor of loving kindness meditation exactly does that. It really has the force to put together the two logs of wood which are dry. There's a moisture there. The connection then allows the true love to appear to ourselves and other beings. It also is able to heal the wounds. We have very deep wounds in ourselves. So beneath lies the source, the fountain of great joy, of peace, of love, of happiness. And it's really a release of the heart, the heart's true release. The practice, which is called the Four Brahma Viharas, Brahma meaning heavenly, Vihara means home or abode. So it's really the four practices that enable the heart to be in their true home. The first practice is loving kindness. The second one is the cultivation of compassion in front of suffering. The third is sympathetic joy. Sympathetic joy is being able to be happy when somebody else is having something which is good for themselves. When the heart is contracted, often what happens is we are jealous, envious, we want what the other person has. We hardly feel very happy. Maybe we are happy very superficially, but behind, if you really look, there's, I wish this would be me. That's not at all sympathetic joy. So it's really being able to be happy when somebody has a great event that is happening to them. The fourth is the equanimity. Equanimity is really the result of the three others. Because it's a concentration practice, what happens is that as we cultivate loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy, there becomes a great equanimity. These three practices give a result that we have a balance of mind which is completely open. A balance of mind which, whatever happens to us, we can take in the pain, we can appreciate the joy of somebody else. Whatever it is, there's a balance of mind and there won't be any reaction. So four qualities of the mind that are very powerful. Very, very powerful. It's a state of consciousness. Now, we usually work with loving kindness. We can say that, to give an example, loving kindness is the foundation of the house. It's really the foundation. And usually, loving kindness is sufficient. If loving kindness has not been developed enough, there's no need to go to compassion, because the other ones are much more difficult to practice. It's out of the loving kindness, the feeling of metta, that naturally will support the compassion, the sympathetic joy, and the equanimity. Not that we don't practice the other ones, but we can stay a very long time with loving kindness without really being very preoccupied with the others. So there's really a capacity of cohesion. And the beauty of it is that it's really our true nature, which means we reteach a thing, ourselves, who we are, it's loveliness. Very easy. It says that the first time the Buddha gave this teaching of metta, of the four Brahma Viharas, it is as an antidote to fear. There was a group of monks that were going to practice in a forest, and he sent them to practice vipassana in the jungle Charles spoke about yesterday, except it was a jungle without tigers but with tree spirits. And the tree spirits did not like the presence of the monks. They were afraid themselves, actually. So what they did is that they manifested ghostly looks. They had horrible sounds, awful smells, and it was absolutely terrifying for the monks to stay in that forest to practice. So they went back to the Buddha and they said, "We're sorry, we can't practice there. We want to go somewhere else." And the Buddha just said, "You know, I will provide you with the only protection that you need. You'll go back to that forest, but I'll give you one practice, which was the practice of loving kindness." And he said, "Don't only recite the phrases, but really do the practice with all your heart. And you'll see if the tree spirits react." And so they went back and they started the practice. And in fact, the tree spirits were completely transformed. They loved the monks and they served them very beautifully. Just to show that the power, the strength of metta, the energy, the flow of that love is huge. It has no limit. It can even touch tree spirits. So by that story, what the meaning is that a mind filled with fear, a mind filled with fear can still be penetrated by loving kindness. Which means that when we're full of fear, absolutely full of fear, and we practice loving kindness, it can uproot the fear. It really can uproot the fear. And that a mind filled with loving kindness cannot be overcome by fear. There's just not the space for the fear to arise. Of course, I don't know how long they practiced to be really completely free from fear. So it means that when we talk about an unconditional love, which is that type of love of loving kindness, it means that it doesn't depend on any condition to be present. You know, in our culture, we use the word love so easily. I love food. I love to walk in a forest. You know, I love this person. We use it in a way that I'm not so sure that we really have the sense of the meaning of love. And that's absolutely normal, because what we're talking about when we talk about love in the Buddhist psychology is said to be the near enemy of metta, of loving kindness. The love that we're talking about is not loving kindness. It's not a pure love. It's love filled with desire, wanting, passion. And that is quite different, actually. we can see for ourselves that the craving comes exactly from that force of the desire that we have in our minds. So there's a distinction to make, and not to mistake one for the other. There's a distinction which really manifests the distortion that the minds have. All of us, actually. And that only comes from the conditioning. Again, the habitual tendencies that we have. The greed. So what we normally call love is desire. There's a lot of wanting, there's a lot of owning, there's a lot of possessing, there's a lot of me in there. Usually, when we want love, we have this sense of needing to have it in a certain way. Now that word need exactly shows that there's a lack of something. When we need something a certain way, or a person to behave in a certain way, you know, I love you if you behave in a certain way, you know. I'm attracted to a person maybe and really like his looks or her looks, and that is desire, which is normal, there's attraction. But then you get to know the person a little better, and then you can start seeing this person through the eyes of the defects, through the eyes of not real pure love. Suddenly this person, which you thought would be the best person for you, doesn't think like you, doesn't want the same thing that you want, doesn't want to go to the beach, wants to go to the mountain, and suddenly there's this huge need of that person to change and to accord to our needs, to want that person to be just what we are. There are a lot of conditions there, plenty of conditions. I have a friend that says, you know, she's absolutely beautiful. And she says, you know, to me, when I practice metta, I just can say that if a friend disappoints me and I practice metta, this person keeps on being a friend. Without the metta, a person can be a really good friend and can disappoint us very often. It's not our friend anymore. We just reject the whole person. Where is the acceptance? So it's for us to be present, you know, to really know where and how we get caught, and to move from that space of desire, of wanting, of craving for something that we need, rather than just through the practice allowing over and over again to meet with a sense of connection, with a sense of openness and allowance. And yes, this person has hurt us, but it's okay. You know, we can work through it. We don't need to feel resented. So the word need reflects a lot. You know, as soon as we have the word need in there, in the space of the mind, there's something that's lacking. And in fact, what do we need in order to be happy? Thich Nhat Hanh says, happiness is available. Have you helped yourself to it? a great phrase, actually, you know. And if we haven't, why not? Why aren't we able to serve ourselves some happiness? It requires an availability to welcome everything. To absolutely welcome everything, even if it's painful. Everything and everyone that shows up, without distinction. Often we have expectations, and it's because we have these expectations that we lack of simplicity. It's just a lack of simplicity, of being just with what we have, just with what is offered to us. So there's a shift there in the contact within ourselves and with the person that we are linked with. There ceases to be a separation. I can also deceive myself, but I can still love myself. There can be great deception, you know, with what we're doing, which is harmful, or maybe what we're not doing, what we expect ourselves to be doing. There can be a lot of deception. Yet, are we allowing ourselves to be deceived? I don't want myself to be this way. There's a rejection there. Instead of just being with the sense of, hey, what is it there? There's something here which I need to be working. Maybe there's anger, maybe there's something, you know, that is hurting. But to look through. So instead of having a narrow vision, you know, a tunnel vision, there's more space which allows the seeing to be much more clear. I was, in a way, what we want is to possess. That craving, to really to the extreme, is that we want to own, to possess ourselves as in a certain way, and to possess and own other beings just so that we can control. And that control, you know, is exactly where is the root of craving, the root of suffering. When we control every single movement that we do, or control the person that we live with, there needs to be a shift there, because that control is exactly where the grasping is. It's exactly there that we cling. And even in the best ways, in the best actions, when I started to do metta, I noticed that it was difficult to have a sense of what the loving kindness meant in the daily practice. So I had a little bit of time just a few years ago, and I volunteered in a hospice where there were only elderly people. I worked there for quite a number of months, and I did that as a practice to practice loving kindness. I can tell you the work was very hard. I had no idea, I have absolutely no medical knowledge, and these people were really in a very bad state. Yet, I was able to keep the loving kindness and sending it in a way that I thought was appropriate. And after some weeks, I thought to myself, you know, I'm sending all this loving kindness, I'm sending all this metta, yet they're not improving. You know, there's nothing better that is happening for them. I mean, this practice is not working. And it was so interesting that, in a way, you know, it seemed to me that I had really done an effort, which was huge. I mean, to volunteer as a volunteer, and my mind wasn't pure at all, in fact. I felt completely betrayed. There was a betrayal because I had, it seemed to me, done everything in a very good way, and they were just not improving. They were not feeling better. They were not, you know, reacting like I thought they would. They should. And so what I did was very, you know, this took a lot of time in my mind. What I did was I took two people who was brought from home into a hospital. She had had a heart attack and was now in that hospice with absolutely no friendliness around her, no family, absolutely no one. And she was just dying because she was drying out. There was no love in her and there was no meaning for life. And so this was the person I chose to send loving kindness to. And it didn't work. So I was very sad in a way, and also, yeah, betrayed. So what I thought would be is I bought her a very nice plant and I put it in her room and I said, you know, why don't you take care of this plant? It would be absolutely wonderful if this plant, it had seeds, there were flowers to be grown in on this plant. And suddenly this woman transformed just because of the presence of the plant. There was some link there, there was some connection that she could make, and suddenly she felt the need to be reliving. That was much more efficient than all the metta. Yet, the practice brought me to the place where I think I can say that I helped the person by doing the right action. So the loving kindness was there. It was just a question of opening my eyes, opening my heart to the need of this person and not to my own need. So condition change, you know, we can see for ourselves when this is happening that it's only a conditioning and that we can be free of that conditioning in a very soft way. Metta also means friendliness, and I've said it quite a few times, you know, to be friendly with oneself. It also, the root meaning also has another meaning with it, which is gentleness, softness, to let oneself be touched in the heart. So in our practice, we keep in daily life, or even in situations which are so-called hard, we can purify ourselves with the mind and counteract these forces of desire. I practice metta very often in the bus. I mean, this is just, or, I don't know, if you're having a ride with someone, whether it's many people on a train, or if you take public transport every day. This is the perfect place to practice just metta. Comfortable position, just 10 minutes to the person that is over there, you know, and you can see that is in a very, very difficult state. Just to practice metta, to connect with that. And the openness of the heart. The other day I was in the bus in Geneva, and doing that gives a sense of, I think, some awakeness and wakefulness. So when there's an elderly person, I usually stand up, you know, and offer my seat. And this younger woman came up to me and said, "But why'd you do that?" I said, "Well, I think this person needs the seat more than I do." And she said, "I would never do that." And then she went on saying, "You know, these people shouldn't take the bus when it's office hours and that we're just, you know, full. They should take the bus between 2 and 4 o'clock. What kind of contraction? And so she was really understanding, and I said, "You know, we just don't have the same feeling about this." And I started to explain my view, and she did soften. I don't know, I just got off the bus just a few minutes later, but she did soften, which means that she said, "Ah, maybe there's something there, you know." So it's also a manner, a way of connecting in a way that we can say to people, "Hey, there's another way, you know." It doesn't always have to be hard. It doesn't always have to be difficult. So when there's desire, a way that we can be practicing loving kindness, which is a very great protection, is to be generous. To be generous in a way that we practice generosity rather than closing and always me, practice generosity. And it's not the generosity of giving in a way that we have this tendency now that it's all generosity through the material stuff, you know. When we give gifts, it's very often that our love manifests through material stuff, you know, which is fine. But there can be a generosity which is much more simple. Just a care for a person, just an attitude of openness, of developing gratitude when somebody is being nice to us. Instead of having this sense of not being enough, when we close, it's just simply never enough. Because there's this sense of need, there's this sense of lack of something. So to be aware of that, simply to know that there can be another way. The far enemy of metta, the near enemy, is desire, and it's really difficult to distinguish desire, greed, with pure love. The far enemy is much more easy to distinguish because it is aversion, it's hatred, it's anger. That's really far away from loving kindness. Now, we can't disguise loving kindness as anger and anger as loving kindness, you know. It's not possible to do that. The states of anger is so painful. It hurts. It tears us apart in a manifested way, which means that when we are in a state, we want to let go. It's so painful that we do want to be free of it. That anger then usually manifests in two ways. It's or an overflow of energy, of very strong, very manifesting, and it comes out in a way that is usually quite obvious, or there's one which is more subtle, which I'd like to talk about just in a few words, which is an aversion which is held in. That aversion which is held in manifests usually as fear. It manifests as fear, it manifests as grief, and it's an energy which is paralyzed, it's frozen. So it's easy to be blocked with it. What do we do when it's frozen? We recognize it again. The only thing that metta can do is to recognize it, to have the proper phase, to know which is the type of aversion. If it's sadness, it's not unhappiness. To be really clear, I had once, you know, a difficulty in just moving the state because I was simply aware of unhappiness instead of sadness. And it's difficult to, if you really think about it, 2 seconds, it's difficult to know exactly the difference between being unhappy or being sad. Yet there is a difference. So to feel the emotion, to feel the emotions with the thoughts, are they only thoughts? Are they only emotions? Is it physical? Is it mental? To open to that state where we realize that we can move the contraction to something which is much more supple, much more flexible. And it changes, you know. It absolutely changes. The conditions change all the time. It doesn't need to be fixed. That blocked energy, that frozen energy, really solidifies most of the time. And it's one, and it's me, and there's identification. So to really be with it. Today, many people in the interviews talked about having some anger. You know, anger is manifesting because we are in touch with ourselves. It's just not that, oh, why should that anger be here? And I'm not doing well. No, it's not that at all. It's that we're much more in touch with ourselves today than 5 days ago. Because we live at a superficial level, we don't realize that maybe there's anger there at a deeper level. But to be in connection with that aversion, that anger, the far enemy of metta, is a releasing of the heart. As soon as we can be with it, it's a releasing of the heart. It's an opening. And we can see that manifestation of the aversion of the anger just as anger. It's not all me, who I am. There's this sense of being so identified when there's an emotion which is so strong. Just anger. It arises and it passes away. Completely different. So to be noting the unpleasantness, to know that there is something which is completely stuck, but rather than pushing it away to get rid of it, being aware, letting it be there, which is quite interesting that we say, you know, allow the anger, accept the anger, just be with the anger. The fact that we let the anger be, it just dissolves at its own rhythm, at its own time. There's a letting go in that manifestation. We don't need to pierce it. And very often there are hidden emotions, very subtle emotions, which are behind the anger. That's why anger is a great way to transform towards wisdom, because it's the anger that allows us to see more hidden emotions. What we can see behind the anger usually. And there's a very big difference again here between, in the Buddhist psychology, between when we are angry and there is something that has been displeasing us. And usually what we do is that we have a sense of guilt. Very often, when that anger manifests in a way or another outwardly, there's a sense of guilt. Now, guilt is something that only reinforces the identification. There's a lot of self-centeredness around that guilt. Guilt is not necessary. There can be a recognition, which we name remorse. And the difference between guilt and remorse is huge. If there's remorse, we just recognize. But with remorse, there is movement. Again, with guilt, it's completely closed in and completely frozen. With remorse, we can recognize. That recognition is simply a regret. We regret to have acted in that way. We have a regret because we harmed ourselves or we harmed another being. That is remorse. But it allows a movement. It allows the state of the mind to just move on, you know, to just, it's okay, we accept it and we can move on to something else. Guilt reinforces the sense of anger, reinforces it. What guilt does, in fact, it reinforces the judging mind. And the judging mind there is really a promotion of guilt, of self-centeredness. There's a promotion of self here. Another way to work is to meet our basic goodness. Rather to see the defects is to meet our basic goodness. And if we have hurt someone, if we have been harmed, both ways, we simply can forgive. Forgiveness is a beautiful practice. That is why that today we did a little bit of forgiveness. And if we work with a difficult person, it's absolutely wonderful when there can be this movement of contraction that moves to an allowing, and we finish up with the forgiveness. That we can forgive, we can let go. That forgiveness is so liberating. It's a letting go. Without rejection. So we open to meet whatever presents itself. Whatever presents itself is liberating. That is the practice of loving kindness. It's a huge, huge help. And I encourage you to do it, you know. I know that sometimes we want to do only the vipassana. And I've been like that, you know, for quite a few months or years in the early practice. I thought vipassana was the thing. And it is, because it is the practice that brings wisdom. But the metta, especially in daily life, is really helpful because it enables us to connect and to just have that opening when there is difficulty, whatever the situation. It frees the mind. Again, the Buddha said, you know, hatred can never cease by hatred. Hatred can never cease by hatred. Hatred can only cease by love. That is an eternal law. It is an eternal law. And the way that loving kindness works is that we tend to notice with practice the intention behind the action. To notice the intention, there is an intention. And that intention, if we notice the intention, we do only skillful actions. We won't harm ourselves or another being. To be at the level of intention, we know exactly what the mind says. That takes practice. Jack Kornfield says, "The heart is our garden, and along with each action, there is an intention that is planted like a seed. We can use a sharp knife to cut someone, and if our intention is to do harm, we will be a murderer. We can perform an almost identical action, but if we are a surgeon, the intention is to heal and save a life. The action is the same, yet, depending on its purpose or intention, it can be either a terrible act or a compassionate act." Let's sit for a few minutes.